Hey everyone, and welcome to the All It Takes is a Goal podcast, the best place in the entire world, including all of Canada, to learn how to build new thoughts, new actions, and new results. I'm your host, John Acuff, and today is a very special episode because it's actually part one of a two-parter. Two episodes in the same week, that's double the content right there. It's true. It's amazing. Today is part one of my interview with Greg McEwen. I'm going to tell you all about Greg in just a minute. But first, today's episode is sponsored by MediShare. Have you guys ever had buyer's remorse? You know, that feeling of intense regret because the thing you thought you just had to have was only something you used once or twice. For me, it was the time I bought a really expensive road bike because I thought I was going to get into cycling. I proceeded to hang it on the wall of my garage and feel ashamed for 6 months. Well, I know some of you are experiencing buyer's remorse right now for something much more frustrating. You know what I'm talking about. It's the healthcare you rushed to get during open enrollment last December. Well, I have some good news for you. You've probably heard me talking about our main sponsor for this podcast, MediShare, and these guys have the answer to healthcare buyer's remorse. Check this out. Members of MediShare save up to 50% or more per month on their healthcare costs. They say the typical family saves up to $500 per month. And here's the best part. You can become a member at any time. So that means it isn't too late to ditch your buyer's remorse and switch to a more affordable healthcare that will save you money and help you sleep better at night. If this is your first time you're hearing about MediShare, it is the best alternative to health insurance that allows you to share the burden of medical bills, offers access to 900,000 plus healthcare providers, and has a proven 25-year track record. Plus, in addition to saving hundreds per month as a member of MediShare, you will also have access to free telehealth and free telecounseling. You won't find that with any traditional health insurance provider. Guys, it only takes 2 minutes to see how much you could save. Go investigate that for yourself and your family at MediShare.com/John. That's MediShare.com/John. Remember, John doesn't have an H in it. So it's M-E-D-I, that's MediShare, SHARE.com/JON. All right, who is Greg McEwen? Greg is a speaker, a best-selling author, and the host of the popular podcast, What's Essential? He has been covered by the New York Times, Fast Company, Fortune, Politico, and Inc. And he's been interviewed on NPR, NBC, Fox, and The Steve Harvey Show. He is also among the most popular bloggers for LinkedIn and is a young global leader for the World Economic Forum. McEwen's New York Times best-selling book, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, has sold more than 1 million copies worldwide. Originally from London, England, he now lives in California with his wife, Anna, and their four children. He also has a brand new book out right now called Effortless that I absolutely love. Why is this episode going to be two parts? Because there's so much in it. This thing is bursting at the seams. Is it bursting at the seams or busting it? It's doing whatever means there's a lot in it. And even though I've never done a two-parter, this felt like the perfect time. So here's part one of my conversation with Greg. Greg, thank you so much for joining me. My first question right out of the gate is, I was on your podcast, What's Essential, and then the very next episode was Matthew McConaughey. So is it fair to tell people that I opened for Matthew McConaughey?
Yes.
I can say that?
I think so.
Okay. Well, you're friends with him, so if he's going to get mad, it's not going to be at me.
Well, I feel like, you know, we might never have got McConaughey if it wasn't for you.
Oh, you think I opened the door? He was like, wait a second.
He said it. He said, anyone who can get John Acuff, I got to be
here. He said it's a yes. That's what pushes PR people.
Clear yes. This is what it is. They said soundtracks, man. The author is soundtracks. It's good. We want
so
to follow
great.
Him.
I love that. Is going to be on my next book. via Greg's mouth, Matthew McConaughey, like this book. It's hard to sell books these days. You got to do any edge you can get.
Any edge.
So the thing I love, we're going to talk about Effortless, your brand new book, which came out just recently. We're going to talk a little about Essentialism. The thing I'm curious about, your book Essentialism sold 1 million copies, which is wicked impossible. I grew up in New England. That's the word very for us. If you looked at it and said, here's the three reasons, or here's what I'd point to, or were there general things that happened? It doesn't sound like there was one thing. Like, none of us have been on the Tonight Show where Jimmy Fallon was like, I read your book in the dentist office and it changed my life. So I want you to be with the Roots. Like, yeah. What happened that made that book kind of over the last few years continue to be such a great seller?
Well, I mean, I think it's about writing something that's relevant, but it's to do it in a way that it's timeless if you can. So actually, one of the things that made Essentialism sort of harder to get off the ground in the first place is, well, I wasn't writing like about politics or about, you know, some urgent thing. I was just talking, in fact, to an author that wrote, you know, a great book. It was about technology. And I think I can say who it was. It's Brad Smith, who wrote a book, Tools and Weapons. He's the president of Microsoft. And he was just talking about this. He was like, you know, Essentialism is like relevant now as what is when it came out, whereas he's just spent a period of time writing three new chapters because technology has gone on so far since he wrote it. So there is a sort of back, well, what's the word I'm looking for? There's like a relationship that the more relevant it is right now, like the most news-leaning book will be the fastest out of fashion.
Sure, sure. Fastest out of date. It's really hot for that minute, but a year later it feels...
Yes, and I think Essentialism just tapped into something that was it was a pain of our period. And for good or ill, I don't see that changing anytime soon. And so Essentialism's had an unusual path because normally it's a very predictable journey. It goes, you know, try and go as big as you can at the beginning and then it dies off. And the question
is slowly watch your failure. Slowly watch a hill of failure.
And Essentialism just hasn't been like that. Essentialism has either been flat or slightly up over those years. And so I think it's about that relevance. I think it's just about something that's perennially relevant. At the same time, I have to just go, I don't know. You know, like there's parts of it that you just don't know. You're trying to listen, you're trying to pay attention to what people, you know, what's going on in their minds. I am writing for the reader. I am trying to channel and to understand and to be empathetic to them. I think it's the number one mistake authors make is to write with their own mind in mind. And you know, what does the world need? I'm going to give them what they need rather than like, what do they want? You know, and what do they want? Because it's a pain point. I don't know if I've covered 3 points. I feel like I've somehow stumbled around with two.
I think the author thing is if I'm the only audience, it's a great way to sell one book. Like if it's, you know, like through my filter of how will this help me, the author, and I haven't, I mean, you talk about an effortless...
So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just want to say, if you did what you just said, you might still write a decent book. But what I think the real problem is you say, I think the world needs this. That's the worst thing. The world needs this thing. And I'm going to give the world what they need. And I'm so passionate. It's not even quite, what do I want right now? You're not even... writing well for yourself. You're just writing for this general, I think the world needs, rather than like, well, people don't buy what they need, they buy what they want. And so you've got to really understand that audience and care about them and like, where are they at? Oh, they're burned out. Oh, where are they at? They're exhausted. Oh, where are they at? They're overthinking. You've got to be in their heads where their world is and then present them with something that someone goes instantly when they see it. I want that right now, an almost physical reaction. So I'm going to give a third thing, which is the graphics and the graphical treatment. So I'm obsessive about this, and I could just be wrong about it. I don't know, but I'm obsessive about
covers. You've got a million books of proof right now. I mean, you can continue to be wrong about new things. You're not wrong about Essentialism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's nice of you to say. I mean, with Effortless so new out, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, sure.
Whether any of the things I think I know, or whether they, you know, they, again, they were just unconscious competence or something. That I obsess about the cover, obsess about the title, obsess about that for this very precise reason, because it's the very first thing, and it always will be, that a reader sees and experiences. And so it's often in a business book genre that the cover is an afterthought. Even the title can sometimes be an afterthought. You can get a cover that's a text treatment. Most business books are, in fact. But it just feels like something's off about that. Like, this is the thing. This is where they begin their journey. And so I'm particularly obsessed about that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that somebody told me once was that you should be clever and clear with a cover, but if you can only be one, be clear. I think great covers hit both. There's cleverness there that invites you in, it entices you, but it's clear what it's about, versus there's times where I'll see covers that go, oh, that was really cool for the author. Like, that was really creative, but it didn't serve the end reader who was confused, and you're not next to them to explain the concept every time somebody's at an airport. And you go, no. It's a play on this thing that happened to me in chapter 7. And if you get to chapter 7, you'll get it.
I saw something you put on Twitter just the last day or two, and you were just stating, like, the first thing is, like, think about the reader, what's in it for me from the reader's point of view. And I think that is it. Somebody once told me, they said, don't write a book that nobody wants to read.
Yeah.
The best advice I have ever had on writing, it's like, that's the problem, is that you get into, well, what does the needs, what the world need? What, it's like, just, do they want to read this? Do they want it? Is there some, what's in it for them? If you can't articulate that, then if you can't, as the author, what are you hoping someone else will figure out?
Well, you're saying to the reader, you figure this out. I think that there's, good luck. Exactly. You figure it out. I couldn't find the through line. You find the through line. So I'm curious, you talk about, you know, the last couple of years you've been on a listening tour. You've gone, that's part of where Effortless came out of, going on this listening tour. I love that phrase. I'm curious from your perspective, when you're listening, you're at an event, you're in a conversation with another author, or you're in a group of people, or even just you're by yourself and you have an idea, how does that idea go from idea you have or idea you heard, need you heard, to it's in a book? Like, walk me through your capture system, your process, like, because I think there's a lot of people that have ideas, but they never make it to a page. What's your system like?
Most of my thoughts go to a paper journal first. So my journal doesn't look like most people's journals, maybe. I mean, I have my daily entries, but I also have just lots of scribbles and ideas, random, and so that there's a place I can go back to them if I want to. That's the first capture. Second capture is to use social media as a, I think social media makes a good servant, but a poor master. I'm using it to test all the time. And certainly if I'm like I'm in a writing mode. Because, just because an idea is interesting to me, just because I go, oh, that's interesting, I've never thought about it that way, something's fresh about that, doesn't mean it will trigger the same way for somebody else and for a lot of people. And so the difference between something that's interesting to me and something that's interesting to a lot of people is fascinating to me. So I'm always wanting to test it there. Once I find that something is resonating, I'll then write an article about it. And try and choose a title that goes with it. Again, all of this is testing. That certainly happened with Essentialism. I was more deliberate on that with Essentialism than I think I have been with Effortless. But with Essentialism, I did exactly what I just described. And the place I was writing was LinkedIn or Harvard Business Review. And then on LinkedIn at the time, it doesn't happen this work this way now, but you could have hugely viral articles all based upon the title of your piece. And so you got this tremendous chance to test titles. And one on HBR that went viral in HBR was called The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And that had so many more comments and reviews and reading that like just established, okay, that is a phrase people relate to. And so this is all this testing so that as you're constructing ideas, those ideas feel resonant and relevant, that they name things for people in a fresh, new, and hearable way. I mean, in a sense, I would call this like something like tactical empathy or strategic empathy something like that, where you aren't putting the pressure on yourself to know, because you don't know. You just accept you don't. And you say, well, you teach me. I'm going to try and do my job of thinking and putting ideas together.
That's good.
And I want you to do your job, which is to tell me which things are relevant and which aren't. And as you help me with that, as the Essentialist community helps you with that, it gives you language back that you can construct so that what you give in the end is really useful to the people you are trying to serve.
I love that. It's so true. My process is similar to that. You mentioned the word pressure. I'm curious, from an author perspective, do you feel pressure to top essentialism? And we talked about this when we talked earlier on your podcast. You know, there's a gap of 7 years between the two books. Mm-hmm. I know every pub, like your book, and you know, I'm not trying to over compliment you, but what you did is unique and amazing in a world where books just don't sell like they used to sell. Mm-hmm. So I know publishers were calling every month saying, hey, you know, it'd be dope, like Essentialism Junior, or like part two, this time it's personal. This one has a shark, like give us re-essentialism. Like I know that was part of, there was some pressure there because when something does well, we want to repeat it. My kid said, Dad, why is there a Pirates of the Caribbean part five? And I said, until it stops making money, they're going to find a new ocean.
They're making $1 billion every time they make those movies. So it doesn't, yeah. It's a strange problem because then you, but the risk is there too, because I mean, I don't know if everyone else agrees, but like, you know, number three, four, five, they're not as good as number one.
It's a thin, you're photocopying a single idea. And by the fifth time you photocopied it, it's not as good. But do you feel current pressure about, okay, I have to top that? Or is that part of you going, you know what, I'm living effortless. And so that changes my ability to share work?
Yeah, I have felt a mix of all of them. Right now in this conversation and this week, I have felt at peace. Mm-hmm. But that is not my, I have struggled with feeling worry and the legitimate fear is like, don't write a rubbish book. That's the only legitimate thing. And even fear.
And people will let you. If you've sold a million copies of a book, people will let you write a bad book.
That is exactly what will happen. And so people will let you write a bad book. And you can point to this. I mean, authors that I love, some of my favorite authors, you can just point to how that happened and how nobody said, listen, that book needs to be 200 pages shorter.
Yeah.
Right? Like 200 pages shorter. Yeah. If you could just cut that up and write, those are two or three different books, and you've tried to make that one thing. I just spoke to somebody just recently who's a family member of an author who I love. And they said, well, this book that they wrote was rewritten like five or six times. Five or six versions of it. The problem is they're all in that book.
Oh, that's such a great way to say it.
And that is exactly true. I know the book. I love and slightly hate it for exactly that reason. It's like there's so much good here, but man, those were too many. There's too many different things being said. And so that's the legitimate concern. That's reasonable. I ought to feel that. I ought to feel responsibility around that. Just don't. And I said it as a mantra. It's not a super great soundtrack, but it was like, don't write a rubbish book. That was my soundtrack. I'm sure I could have improved upon that, but still that was there. But the things that haven't been helpful are where you're comparing it against essentialism, you're comparing it against other books that are phenomenon. That stuff's just like you live in the gap, not in the gain. And that's a phrase that Benjamin Hardy introduced to me when he was on the What's Essential podcast, is he said, just as a question, are you living in the gain or in the gap? And when I'm in the gap, that's painful. There's no point of success. There's no place where you've written enough books or that they've sold enough copies that you couldn't still be in the gap. Yeah. I mean, I was just reading the bio for Agatha Christie, who sold 1 billion copies in English and 1 billion in the rest of the world. Like,
she's crushing J.K. Rowling, by the way. J.K. Rowling could look at her and be like, I'm terrible. I'm terrible. I've only sold 600 million, but I have a theme park.
There's no point at which you can't be in the gap. So it's not about the level of success. There's an orientation. And when you're in the gain, when you pause and you look at how far you've come. I mean, when I came to America 20 years ago, I could not write, and it's not false modesty, I could not write a decent essay. Actually, I didn't know how to write a good essay. I'd written lots of essays, but I didn't know thesis, structure, conclusion, how to arrange your evidence. I didn't know that. And I didn't have any money. My parents didn't go to college. As far as I'm sure that they completed high school. I had nothing. I wrote I did a project, a self-initiated project where I self-published when I was in, that's my, the level of what I was writing at that time is so different. That's where I came from. When I can keep that perspective in mind, the whole thing's upside. It's just so enjoyable.
Yeah. It's all gravy. It's all gravy.
It's all upside. Seriously, every single interview, doing this interview is this upside. 20 yeah. years ago, you didn't have it, there weren't podcasts and so on, but like nobody was saying, hey, can we just interview? I'd love to just hear what you have to say about it. There was yeah. nothing. So everything's yeah. upside. And I think that being in that place makes it far more enjoyable. And I think it generates success too, because you just, I don't know, you're sort of relaxed into it and the creation comes to you and ideas come and you can take advantage of the opportunities that are there instead of reducing and diminishing them by thinking about all the things that are not there yet.
I love that. I think that's fascinating. And some of these questions are because I'm similar in that I have a book that just came out. I'm always curious about, you know, when
a terrific book that just came out.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Matthew McConaughey has been talking about it a lot, apparently, which is just helpful.
Soundtracks is just terrific. And you know, sometimes it's weird because on your own podcast, it can be weird to talk about your own book. Like you can, and I'm sure you have, anyone who's listening to this that hasn't bought the book yet. So they feel like they're sort of, yes, I'm a follower. I'm loyal to John. And they don't, but just go and buy the book. It really matters. It really helps.
That.
And they should do it. I now have 3 copies.
I love it. I love it.
And I love it.
We get to text and interact off a podcast, which is really fun. That's the best part to me is when yep. you actually develop a friendship with somebody and go, that person's not an idea. They're an individual. And I actually get to know them.
Yeah, I love that too.
You know, you and I talked a lot about light and easy, Matthew 11:30, you know, yep. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. Why do people have such a hard time allowing things that matter to be light and easy? That question feels like it's the core of effortless.
I mean, I can tell you the answers. I always feel like I need to answer it like today, what I know today versus the book. But there are some good answers to that in the book, I think, that I learned. One is just Puritanism, that there's a foundational idea that said hard work is good, it's a virtue, it's a value. And they went further than that to say ease is a vice. So that positioning underscores this idea that we distrust the easy and we think everything has to be hard. That's one reason. I'll say another reason, which is sort of on the other side of the maybe of the sort of spiritual religious continuum, is that sophistry also distrusts the easy, but for a different reason. Oh, if it's not complex, if it's not if somehow not impressive to the intellectual pride within me, then I'll dismiss it. So simplicity gets distrusted, ease gets distrusted, but again for a different reason. And you quoted Matthew. There are biblical stories to illustrate it, right? Maybe you remember, I can't remember exactly the names, but somebody comes to Elijah, they want him to be healed, and he says, well, wash yourself 7 times in the River Jordan, and he goes, what? And he sent a servant out to send, and he's like, my pride is all bent out of shape, I'm not doing that. What's so special about this river here? And he's almost not going to do it. His servant friend says, just do it. Like, if he'd said do some great thing, then you would have done it. And so just do it, do this thing. And he does, and he's healed. And so that idea of whether it's from the work ethic side of like distrusting the easy, or whether it's sophistry distrusting the simple and easy, I think that these things are all just get in the way that there is a path that is both virtuous and simpler. That is a more effortless way to do life.
Do you think that like modern motivational stuff gets in the way of that? Because I look at phrases, the things like, if your dream doesn't scare you, it's not big enough.
No pain, no gain. No pain, no gain.
No pain, no gain. Like, that's what are things deep that we shout in gyms that are actually not helpful to long-term success?
No pain, no gain has got to be one of the top ones for this. Like, what a soundtrack. Like, I want to say something like, what a stupid soundtrack. No pain, no gain. Let's have pain in our lives. That's the only way to make progress. That doesn't seem very useful. Maybe it's true in the gym. Maybe. Even there, what you really want is consistency. You want to be able to be there 6 months from now. So if you really do no pain, no gain, right? If you take that literally from the first day you go in there, you're not going to survive past the first week.
Nobody wants 6 months of pain. Nobody would say, like, there's no reward that you'd go, you know what? I do want 6 months of pain. That is, I have a pair of jeans I really like. I want to be able to fit into them. I will give 6 months of pain for that pair of jeans. That's a terrible trade.
Yes, it is. And also just this idea of, I mean, no pain, no gain in the gym. Like, you, if you really do that when you haven't worked out, you're going to can't walk the next day. You literally are just, that isn't what it means anyway. It's not even, the people that do it well, yes, you feel a little achy the next day. You pushed yourself past a certain limit, but it's still within a certain bound. They're just doing it consistently and that captures something. But I think people overdo that. So, I mean, that would be an example of what people say. But I was just in did some work with a committee that the leader said, the capable leader in lots of ways. And they just said at the end of this meeting, this kickoff meeting, they said, this could affect millions of people. It could be such a benefit, such a blessing to so many people. I mean, it's going to be really hard, but it's going to be really worth it. And I'm like, no one questioned it. Nobody challenged it. They didn't think that they'd said anything that was, they were speaking, they were singing out of a hymn book that is so established that no one even heard it. And but, I mean, I definitely heard it, but that's because I've been sort of living in this this space for a while now. And I'm like, well, why? Does it have to be? Is it just as essential stuff have to be relentlessly hard? Could there be a way to make the most essential? How can you make this the most essential activities the easiest ones in your life? Anyway, that seems like a good question to ask.
Does shame get in the way of that? Like, I've seen some people who are high performing, and when it starts to come naturally, they feel like, okay, I'm about to get lazy. I have to level up. It has to be harder. Does shame come in there too? Like, it's too easy, or other people have it harder. I should have it hard too. Like, does that get in the mix?
Yes, I think it's all part of the same paradigm that I think is so limiting. Now, I am in favor of people working. I'm in favor. If you aren't doing anything and you've got a dream and you want to achieve something and you're doing nothing, yeah, that isn't going to work out for you. Of course, you've got to take action. Of course, you've got to put in some effort. That's like just level zero to level one. But that usefulness gets used up fast. People, past a certain point, you can't put in more hours. Like, how many hours can you put in? There's a limit. And so to push in more hours doesn't suddenly get you double the results and 10 times the results. No, you have to develop a new strategy. And yet when people get into this mindset, they don't unlearn the lesson they need to. And start discovering a different, a better strategy, a smarter approach, an alternative. They just go, a little effort got me some results. Well, a lot of effort is going to get me better results. And then if I kill myself, I'm going to have incredible results. And then people get burned out. They don't even know they're burned out because they're burned out. Like, that affects their discernment. And then they think, okay, well, the answer is to power through. I think actually a lot of people have done that over the last year. You know, they've got the results they've got through this grinding effort. They're killing themselves. And they just don't even know there's an alternative, that there's another path. And there is.
I loved the pace chapter 10 about pace, where you talk about this exact thing about, I'm going to power through. And some people take that approach. If somebody said, okay, this, my podcast is all it takes is a goal. I've got a bunch of goals. I've used power through for a lot of my life, but I'm realizing it's got diminishing returns. You talk about that in the book, diminishing returns. What would you say to that person to say, hey, what if you set an upper limit? What if you, like the story you tell about, you know, trying to reach the South Pole, the explorer who set the 15-mile pace every day, reached it, the guy who would go 45 miles and then no miles, all five of them died. Like, the story is very clear which path ends up better.
Yes.
What would you say to somebody to say, you know, help me set a pace? What does pace look like?
Well, I mean, just speaking again to that story for just a second, you summarized it. Fantastic. There's a moment at which the team that makes it, it's the Amundsen team, it's the Norwegian team, are 45 miles from the South Pole. No one's ever in human history achieved this. They've never got there. And he is within 45 miles. He has perfect weather conditions. And if he just pushes through now, in one day he can get it. He doesn't know where the competitor team is. There's Captain Scott from Britain. He doesn't know where he is. So he could be 2 days behind him. And if he rushes with one day, he'll get there, he'll get the victory. And still, he takes 3 days to make that trip. He still does it 15 miles on average those last 3 days. He averages 15.5 miles per day the entire trip. succeeds and also gets home alive. And as you say, the other team dies. The biographer, speaking of what has got to be, at least in my mind, one of the greatest, most challenging physical tests imaginable. But that's why no one has done it in 1,000 years, 2,000 years of recorded history. No one has ever done it. They describe the experience. He says they achieved this goal, and this is the quote, without particular effort.
Which is crazy.
It's crazy. That's the maddest thing to say of that. And of course, you've got to take it within context. Of course, there was effort. Of course, there were challenges. But to summarize the approach as without particular effort is like, it's just amazing. And that's what happens if you get into pace. If you let go of this heroics paradigm, where the only way to achieve stuff is through crazy heroics, if you can get past that, you actually open up precisely the strategy to help you break through to the next level of contribution, but without burning out. And so, yes, I mean, it's a counterintuitive approach. When you set a goal, you set a minimum bound. That's a good idea, right? I won't do less than this. I did it with journal keeping. It's not the most interesting one, but I said, okay, I'm going to write no less than one sentence a day. That makes sense because you want consistency. But a lot of people, when they set a goal like that, okay, I'm going to write my journal, the first day they write 3 pages. They write a veritable essay, but day two, they don't have time for that. So they don't do it. Then day three, they're like, oh, I've got to make up for day two. Then that's it. It's over before they've begun. So intermittent. So intermittent progress is a poor way to break through to the next level of results. It doesn't work. It works really poorly in terms of superior performance. So if you set an upper bound, for me with the journaling, it was saying, okay, no more than 5 sentences a day. Until this thing becomes effortless, until it's built into my routine, until I'm enjoying it, until it just works. And so I haven't missed a day. To my recollection, I have not missed a day in writing my journal in 10 years now. And it's because you have an upper bound.
Have you extended the upper bound in the 10 years?
Yeah, I don't even have an upper bound anymore with it.
Because it's natural, it's effortless.
It's just part of the thing. I carry the journal with me everywhere I go. I enjoy doing it. It's a ritual for me. But even now, I'll still, if I find I'm getting behind, if there's been 2 or 3 days, I'm like, oh, I've got to make up for that. I'll say, okay, no less than one sentence, no more than 5 sentences. I'll still go back to that if I get off track.
So good. So good. You still have it as a framework that serves you long term.
Totally. And this is the thing. It's consistency. That is the power, right? Is if you can do something consistently, then you start to get all of those compounding benefits that we all know about. But it's true for any goal whatsoever. If you say, okay, I'm going to read this book, I'm going to read, I know someone who set a goal to read Anna Karenina like 20 years ago. And he hasn't finished it. It's still a goal. He could just say, okay, forget it. I'm never going to do it.
Yeah.
It's still a goal. If he'd had an upper bound and a lower bound, he would have done it, right? Even a huge book like Anna Karenina, you'd do it no problem. No less than one page, no more than 10 pages. And you just stick to it. Absolutely any goal you want, almost any goal you want can be built into an upper bound situation. And it's counterintuitive. I took up swimming again with my family. That's a new ritual. I wanted to go swim. I was swimming 100 lengths. The last time I swam was 100 lengths before they closed the pools down with the pandemic. Finally, they opened back up. Beautiful weather, we're going to go do this. I just felt like trying to push it. I just felt like, let's go. Maybe not 100. I felt like that might make me just ill, but I was like, I want to go. And then I remembered this, like upper bound. And I said, okay, 40 lengths, which for me was not a struggle. And did 40 lengths. And the next day, I felt like doing more. No, 40 lengths. Next day, same. But until I'd done a week, and then I said, okay, 50 lengths. And then it stayed at 50. Like, you don't have to push. In fact, don't push. If you want to achieve breakthrough performance, don't push so hard. Don't force anything. Don't push anything beyond a certain thing. So there's a little left in the tank for tomorrow so that you can get the consistency.
I love that principle. All right. That is the end of part one. Is it me or Do things sound smarter when they're said with a British accent? Greg could read a restaurant menu and I'd be like, that is brilliant. I love capers and arugula. Part two of my interview with Greg McKeown will launch on Friday, May 21st. Make sure you don't miss it. Thank you so much for listening today. If you love this episode, please leave a review. The reviews you've been leaving have been awesome. I'll see you on Friday. And remember, all it takes is a goal. This episode of the podcast was brought to you by MediShare. Text John, J-O-N, to 474747 for more information. Huge thank you to MediShare for sponsoring it. J-O-N to 474747.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about the All It Takes Is a Goal podcast and to get access to today's show notes, transcript, and exclusive content from John Acuff, visit acuff.me/podcast. Thanks again for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode of the All It Takes Is a Goal podcast.